Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to episode 84 of Speaking of Mysteries. Today I'm talking to James R. Scarantino about his recently published The Drum Within. The novel, the first in a series, takes place in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and introduces us to the remarkable police detective, Denise Aragon, who is tracking the killer of a young woman found in a car's trunk, and investigating the death of a prominent defense attorney's wife who may have been the victim of a serial killer. Here's Jim Scarantino talking about The Drum Within. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest today is James R. Scarantino, who's first in a series, although not first mystery, who's first in the series, The Drum Within, has just been published. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be speaking with you, Nancy.
First of all, details. When was the book published?
The book was released in February 8th, just last month of this year, 2016.
So now I'm going to get to my questions. You live in the Pacific Northwest, but The Drum Within, which is the first in a series, takes place in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm curious why you chose New Mexico and Santa Fe in particular.
Well, I lived there for 30 years. That might do it. I started writing the book there and did not have any luck landing an agent out of New Mexico, although several agents there were interested. And I moved to the Pacific Northwest, you know, I put all that behind me, and what do? Bang, I sell a series set in Santa Fe. So I spend my mornings literally, not literally, but figuratively, still in New Mexico, even though I look out on a misty, foggy Discovery Bay here on the Olympic Peninsula.
Tell us about your protagonist, Denise Aragon, the Santa Fe Police Department detective who initially catches the murder case of Linda Fagler.
Well, she is actually somebody I grew to admire the more I wrote her. She reminds me of a lot of the female police officers, detectives, prison officers I knew, and I did want to honor them with a character who I felt captured the essence of what it is to be, what it is like to be a woman in that situation where there's no doubt your work is going to change you. Denise brings her own motivations, which I'm not going to spoil for the readers, but she is driven intensely. Her greatest fear is letting the bad guy go, and she became a police officer because she, as a teenager, she had seen a tragedy where some very bad people were let go by police incompetence and the indifference of judges. She is a character she's a study, I should say, in how we respond to trauma in our lives. I was reflecting this morning that all the characters in this book show us the different ways human beings respond to injury, abuse, the ugly things we see in life, and they all go off in different directions. Denise runs straight at it. She has a friend in the book who, in response to the same violence in their teenage years, became a Buddhist priestess. And she reflects on how different they are and how Denise's response to this was to run straight at the violence. She always seeks to be stronger, run better, you know, better, faster, higher, you know, tougher. And she recognizes her own shortcomings because her physical stature is not much. She is a small person. But she recognizes that on the street, she's going to have to do something about that. So she has put on a lot of muscle. She picks up martial arts skills. She is very, very good with a firearm. And this doesn't spoil anything because it comes out in the first chapter. I mean, she cuts her hair off so it can't be grabbed in a fight. She trims her fingernails down so she can never be accused of an excessive violence charge when she arrests somebody. She also, though, carries with her a lot of integrity. And in the book, I have sort of two parallel tracks. And one track the book opens with is with the dead girl in the trunk. which Denise and I solved together, by the way, because when I set that up, I had no idea that murder had occurred. None. And because I wanted to be in her character. And when detectives, when police come across a crime, they don't know what happened. You know, it's great to be the omniscient author, but I explored that crime with her, and we sort of solved it together. But that is there to show a different side of her, which is her, I think, her integrity, that she risks a lot to uphold the reason why she became a police officer. While on the other hand, when it comes to getting the bad guy, if the law and the niceties of criminal procedure stand in the way, her goal is to get the bad guy. And then they get pushed aside.
Yeah, she doesn't stand too much on ceremony. I mean, she's obviously a very, very good investigator and a good cop. And I think it's extremely interesting that that she is a fully formed character in your mind, and you saw yourself in partnership with her to solve the crime.
I did. I would have conversations with her. I laid out the facts, the forensics, the clues, and I take this from Michael Connelly, and Harry Bosch always says, it's always in the murder book. You know, he goes all over the place, and it comes back to the murder book. And I set up that first scene with that in mind, that everything necessary for her to solve that crime was there, but I had no idea how it was going to be solved, nor did she. And it was, you know, and the writing process was exciting. Because it was truly a journey of discovery together with Denise Aragon.
I thought a lot of the book and the characters in the book were driven by a sense of both identity and the perception of identity. The chief suspect in this book, not of the initial crime that Denise discovers, the woman in the trunk, but another crime, is a man named Cody Geronimo, who's an artist, and he's identified himself as an Indian. And that identification seems to give him this almost mystical persona to his fans. In other words, he uses being a Native American as a marketing tool.
Right.
In Detective Aragon's case, she identifies herself as a Latino and a cop in equal measure. And I wonder if this was an intentional look at the Southwest's unique cultural mix.
Very much so. Very perceptive of you. And that happens with some other characters in the book. Santa Fe is a fascinating place. There is an extremely wealthy upper class that commutes to Los Angeles and Beverly Hills and New York. And Denise Aragon doesn't come from that. She doesn't come from the Hispanics or Latinas who frequent the galleries on Upper Canyon Road and who are at tailgate parties for the opera. In this next book, I talk more about her heritage. Her family's been there 500 years. Aragon is indeed a royal name, and we explore that, how her family arrived in New Mexico. She is part of the generations of Hispanics who've been pushed out of the city they founded, and they live on the edges. Her neighborhood, around a place called Killer Park, is where they live. Or the next generation lives in the trailer parks, completely outside of town. And there is a lot of class conflict. There's an overlay of the racial conflict that's there, with Cody Geronimo exploiting his true or false Native American identity for marketing purposes, and also for some leverage in terms of his lawyer uses it to protect him. Denise Aragon, she carries a chip on her shoulder. I think that's very evident. She's got a lot of resentment as to what's happened to her Santa Fe. You have the upper-class whites who exploit the society and the lower classes. And I use that tension a lot. And you've got some of those whites resenting, some of the training they get about cultural sensitivity, too, you know, the older white guys. And that is a background for a lot of this story. And what's not told in this book is how Santa Fe has continued to change with the influx of even a poorer generation from Mexico that lives way on the edge of town. And that is a Santa Fe you're not going to read about so much in the guidebooks or the New York Times, you know, Sunday Magazine, or places like that. But that is the very, very real story of Santa Fe. A friend of mine who's an investigative reporter, he's now at a newspaper in San Diego, told me a story that inspired a lot of this. And the East Side is where the rich white people live, the movie stars, the wives of the CEOs who were in Chicago and New York. And they didn't like that there was this ballpark in the middle of their neighborhood where it was noisy and rowdy, and they tried to stop the sale of alcohol, just beer, for a baseball game. If they have, Santa Fe has like a minor league team. And there was this hearing that went on for hours, and the line went out the door. And it had nothing to do with beer. And Hispanics who had been going to that ballpark their whole lives lined up, and their testimony was pointing their fingers at the white city councilors. It was all about racial tension. You don't want to see us. You know, this is genocide.
Well,
this
we
was
should...
about beer at a baseball game. That is the underlying current that runs throughout so much of Santa Fe that doesn't get written about very often.
And we should add that Santa Fe is the oldest city in the United States.
It is.
And it was not founded as one of the British colonies. It was founded by Spain.
Yep. And in the book, there's Denise Aragon repeats a long-running resentment about people coming from New York and California saying, you know, telling others how they discovered Santa Fe. Boy, that really irritates the original Hispanics that are still around that area.
I was also intrigued by the conflict between the city's two top defense attorneys. And one of them is Walter Fegler, whose wife is a murder victim in the story. And then his one-time protege, Marcy Thornton, who is representing the man of, accused of killing her former boss's wife. And I understand that criminal law is adversarial in nature, but wow.
Yeah, well, I've seen it. I've been a prosecutor and a defense lawyer, and I've been in conversations with other defense lawyers and worked cases with them, and I've been in an office with other defense lawyers, and this story, the actual genesis of this story was Walter Fager's character. You know, he's sort of a composite of various defense lawyers who would love to brag that they're the most badass lawyer around. They love pulling shenanigans and tricks, and the worse their client they get off, the better. And I remember a thought going through my head after I'd seen one case where a defense lawyer had set up cops for failure. And it's similar to the setup at the very beginning of this book about somebody who did something very horrible, getting off on a technicality where the officer was truly innocent in their intentions. And I remember thinking, well, what if this was, that was your child who died and you're on the receiving end of this? How would you feel about a lifetime of investing in friendly judges, which happens, shaping procedure to benefit your criminal clientele, lobbying the legislature for things that benefit the criminal class, and then you're now on the receiving end of something you built? And out of that came his Frankenstein, Marcy Thornton, his protege, who he was bragging, you know, he'd show off his tricks to her and this and that, and she took everything she learned from him and ratcheted it up quite a few more notches. And she's part of his dilemma, that he's now a victim in a system that for a lifetime he manipulated for the benefit of people who hurt other people.
Well, turnabout,
I'm very curious about how somebody would react to that.
Yeah, turnabout is not fair play in this book, because it really, she is delightfully crazy pants evil, Marcy Thornton.
She's a lot like her client. She is. Everybody else in the book responds to the trauma, hurt, and abuse in their life in some way. Either they become very, very loyal. They step up to the fight. They become bitter. They have this horrible, dark seed buried within them that twists their conduct, except in the case of Marcy Thornton. And you could say she is a sociopath with a law license.
And very, very entertaining.
Good, because I wanted to have fun with those two.
I mean, she's evil, but boy, is she I guess fun is the wrong word. It's vicarious. It's just sort of like if you're going to read an evil incarnate, you might as well make it a stylish one and you know, sort of just totally, not totally. The thing is she's not over the top, because I'm sure there are defense attorneys. Let's put it this way. I didn't have to suspend disbelief too much to read Marcy and sort of nod and go, wow, that's interesting and yet believable.
You know, she's the kind of person that is just doing bad things in the normal course of the day. You know, she's doing her nails and talking about doing something really horrible. She's making an appointment for a massage after she's, you know, just done something really horrible. It's just part of her everyday life and existence, and it is the party for her. She is gleeful about it. She just enjoys the power trip. She enjoys taking the things she learned from her boss, showing him up, building her practice, and just being on top of the whole game. And
of course, she's an aider and abettor.
Gleeful is the word I apply to her.
She's an aider and abettor of people with similar inclinations. So she's kind of a giver in that regard. I once attended a panel at the LA Times Book Festival on noir fiction, and the moderator differentiated noir from other crime fiction subgenres by its character seeking not only the wrongdoers, but also redemption. And the Drum Within had a pretty nasty serial killer on the loose, but I don't think that alone made it a noir thriller. I think it's what the characters were seeking for themselves. Is that a correct characterization?
Yes, it is. And we won't, you know, there's the arc in there for one of the main characters, which is not quite complete. Denise Aragon doesn't buy that somebody can change, even with horrible trauma in their lives. But that is there. It's more a story about the people who deal with the violence and horrors in the world. I didn't particularly want to write a book about a serial killer. To be in that person's head, to presume to explain what makes a serial killer tick. How many interviews were conducted with Ted Bundy? I mean, did anybody get any answers? I studied a serial killer up here who operated in the Olympic Peninsula around the country named Israel Keyes. And they're just evil. And I thought it more interesting and more entertaining and more noir, and it hadn't been done as much, to look at the people who profit by keeping an operator like Cody Geronimo in business. I mean, how can they do it? And we find that one of them actually enjoys it. And I think that's an explanation for some of these people. Cody Geronimo, if I may mention, was inspired by R.C. Gorman. I don't know if you picked up on that in the acknowledgments at the back. He was a famous Taos artist, very, very popular. Hobnobbed with Elizabeth Taylor and Mick Jagger and, you know, politicians. And he was a pedophile. And he was exposed by an investigative reporter. He and I are going to be on a radio show in Albuquerque in a couple weeks talking about the book and his work. And there was a whole power structure in New Mexico that kept R.C. Gorman, double entendre intended here, in business, both abusing boys and making lots of money for people. And it went on for years. And the system was geared to shutting down anything to stop him. And he inspired Cody Geronimo. So I found that side of that crime situation the interesting thing that I wanted to write about, as well as, you know, what happens to somebody like Walter Fager when he's now on the receiving end of the system he built.
Crime fiction writers are often former criminal attorneys, prosecutors, or journalists, and you're all three. So I wonder which part of your other careers has most informed your novels. What background are you calling upon the most, or is it all equal?
It's all of them. I mean, I started as a young prosecutor in Philadelphia in a courtroom where eventually the judge and all his deputies and bailiffs were arrested on corruption charges. I had a nice upbringing, and here I'm in Philadelphia, just one horrible crime after another. But in all of that, I saw stories, and I started writing short stories back then. It was the stories that were fascinating, more than the negotiation that is much of what law is about. I became a criminal defense lawyer and saw that side of it, and I got to work closely with some of the best criminal defense lawyers in the country, and some of the twisted people, and some of the criminal defense lawyers who couldn't manage to make a living at anything else, who weren't very good. And I saw them and how that worked and how, it was interesting. And then the investigative reporting part, which is how I finished my career, was about the most fun I ever had, because then I didn't have to deal with judges. I could just do my stories and throw up facts that I knew were dead solid and, had quite an impact in New Mexico. But all of it went into the writing here. All of it informed my characters, my research. The one thing it didn't inform was how to write. There's a little different style in the book that I had to work at because I was trained to write as a lawyer, which is about the most boring prose you ever want to read. And I had to drill that out of myself. So I like to say Elmore Leonard set me free. I studied his 10 rules. I didn't follow him every one of them. They were not intended to be strict rules. Elmore Leonard would never say this is the rule you have to follow. But they sure informed me, and they helped me get myself completely out of the story and become invisible. So it was truly driven by characters. And it was fun because then I'm not responsible for. And they took the story in places I did not expect, because the more they became alive and real, the more they were doing things that I couldn't control. And that was fun, because then the story went places that made it a lot more interesting.
Well, St. Leonard has got to be one of the best inspirations for any noir crime fiction writer. He's the guide for so many. And
it's not easy. I mean, his rule looks simple, but I mean, they come from a lifetime of his of writing every day, right? He used to start at 5 a.m., which is about when I start writing. But they're distilled from a lifetime of learning. Some of them are tough, particularly the one, if it sounds like writing, get rid of it, alter the objective of making the author invisible. That is a tough one. That is a tough one, but it makes for much better literature if you hit that mark.
I ask this of journalists who have become fiction writers, crime fiction writers specifically, and that is, was it easy to start making it up, or was it hard to start making it up? Because it pretty much falls into 50-50.
Well, I tell myself when I sit down to write, I'm about to write fiction, not lies. Fiction means, you can take things from life, you can have fun with facts, you can set scenes that aren't real, but it cannot be a lie. It has to be true to the world we live in, to the way people are, to our knowledge and limited states of knowledge. And to that end, I didn't find it difficult. Because like I said, I created a murder scene. I had no idea how it was going to end. Well, here comes the investigative reporter skills. Here comes the lawyer digging into the facts. And I research hard. I really drill down. I read scientific treatises to make sure I'm getting the science right. I consult with people, and that was great. I love the research part of the book. So at the end of the book, I never wanted to have the police, Denise Aragon, doing something that was false, doing something that was a lie, being perfect. If you notice, the book starts out with her making a mistake.
Right.
Now here's your hero. Boom, right away she makes this huge mistake. And that happens to police officers all the time, and I think that's very true. I mean, she has inappropriate attitudes frequently that bubble to the surface, and I think that's very real for most police officers, regardless of their race or background, because they live You know, they're down in the sewer every day, and you develop feelings and attitudes. And so at the end of the book, you know, even though it was fiction, I wanted it to be true. And I think that is in sync with the instincts of an investigative reporter, to report that which is true.
It's true in the universe that you have created.
Well, thank you. That's a high compliment. Thank you very much.
Well, you touched on this earlier in our conversation, and this is generally my last question of the interview, was what is next for Jim, and what is next for Denise Aragon?
Well, book two is done. My publisher has it. And book two, do you notice this book ends with a lot of unfinished business? Although you get a sense justice is going to be done, you haven't seen it done. Book two literally picks up with the next sentence of the interrogation that ends book one. And it goes on from there. And that was a lot of fun writing that one. I wrote that book and finished it, polished it in 90 days.
And wow.
I thought I was going to go nuts. My wife was worried about me because, if you notice, I get into the heads of the characters to write everything from their perspective. but it just flew. I think it may be better. And so that one's done, and I'm working on book three. So it's a three-book contract, and I'm well into book three. And I head to New Mexico to conduct more research and eat lots of green chili and smell the wood smoke and walk the mountains and walk the streets and listen to people. And I leave for a couple weeks for that. I'm going to be there for a while to mainline the land of enchantment, get it back in my system. And I just keep writing. That's my job. Like I said, I'm at my desk 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. And I take it as seriously as Elmore Leonard did.
And that's to our benefit, because this is it's a fascinating, I found it a fascinating book set in an interesting place. And as you pointed out, coming from a different perspective, not from the perspective of someone who attends the Santa Fe Opera and goes to the galleries, but from the residents and descendants of the original people who lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which was certainly the back and beyond for the eastern United States, but kind of the center of the universe for Spanish America.
It was. It was the capital. It was the end of the road. It was the center of everything. And there's still a lot of pride among those people for very, very good reason. I mean, when you think about their journey and what they did and what they built and how remote they were from the rest of the world, that their accomplishment cannot be diminished. And yet, in many respects, they're on the short end of the stick because they were so successful.
Well, thank you again for talking to us about your novel, The Drum Within, about your next novel, and about your characters. I'm hoping that the listeners will seek the book out and buy it. It's really, really good.
Well, thank you, Nancy. It's been a delight talking to you.